Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now, on Last Call, waiting for the real pullback. Stocks getting spooked as yields spike, but there's one big number that all of you need to see and hear. A climactic ending, the final push on for the battle for Disney's heart and soul. Forget chocolate prices for one vital dairy product suddenly hitting the accelerator. Past the salt deduction, a major decision coming down over one of the most important tax deductions out there, especially for all of you on the coast. Blowing the roof off, home insurance costs surging to records, and the worst spots, they may not be where you think. Plus, a one-woman juggernaut, Iowa's Caitlin Clark, set to transform team sports as we know them. Commissioner of the WNBA is here. All that and more over the hour, so belly up or buckle up, because Last Call is up right now. Well, good evening here. Good afternoon out west. I'm Brian Sullivan. All that and more coming up across the hour. But first up on Last Call, call it crude's warning to the world. If you're not paying attention, you should be. Oil hitting its highest price this year, over $85 a barrel in the States, and probably about to go over $90 a barrel globally. The pop really coming for a lot of reasons, but there's two main ones. Number one, Ukraine stepping up its strikes against Russian oil. Today, Ukrainian drones damaging Putin's third largest refinery. This despite the fact that the White House has reportedly asked Ukraine to let up on attacking Russian oil, likely fearing higher gas prices heading into the election. And two, Iran vowing retaliation over an Israeli attack on its embassy in Syria, which killed two of Iran's top military commanders. There's also growing concern that Israel might soon launch a ground invasion into Lebanon. All of this happening as OPEC is set to meet virtually tomorrow, as the world watches to see if these higher prices will force OPEC and its allies to ease up on their production cuts. Now, they are not expected to make a change, but this is OPEC. Prices are up. You never know. Let's talk about all this together with RBC Salima Croft, also CNBC contributor, coming out to the office. And we appreciate you on set because it's a huge story. And I honestly, for the life of me, I don't know why it's not getting more national, not business, but national media attention, Ukraine going deeper into Russia than they ever have. How big of a deal is this?
I mean, this was the longest range drone attack we've seen since January. We've had 14 refineries hit, more than 13% of refining capacity offline. Ukraine is essentially saying, if we're not getting the money and not getting the weapons from the United States, we're going to go after Russian oil because we're going to try to defund this ATM for the war machine.
I could make the bull and the bear case. When you first talk about attacks and we all want to see Putin get his tail kicked and all this stuff, you would think, oh, this is bullish, meaning prices are going to go up. But I could also see a situation, Halima, where if you can't refine,
you push more crude onto the market.
You got a lot of oil just sitting around.
So this is the interesting question. Will the Ukrainians start going after export infrastructure?
That would spike prices.
And it's clearly in range. Like, you look at the export facilities, they are adjacent to many of these terminals. So it's a targeting choice they're making for now. Do they basically say, soon, everything's on the table? I think they're calibrating the attacks. They're going after refined products, you know, keeping diesel from going to the front lines, hitting refined product exports. But the question is, if they believe that they have a window of opportunity that may be closing if Trump is elected, mm-hmm. do you need to change the tide in the war now?
Yeah, this is the U.S. and ally strategy in World War II, by the way. I mean, my grandfather would tell me stories about how there were just tanks and planes that couldn't run because we had blown up all the German refineries and the war machine just shut down. I could see prices, to your point, going down in oil if they continue, because to your point, that oil has to go somewhere. What if Ukraine were to start striking the export terminals.
I mean, can you imagine a situation?
What would the White House do, by the way?
I mean, the White House, I think,
would lose their mind.
They'd be furious. And the question is, does that matter? And what you are hearing from of Ukraine's allies is essentially saying, like, look, we had a bargain. We said we would not go after oil exports. We would not target the energy infrastructure, but you would give us money and weapons. And so the question is, does that bill that is stuck in Congress, does Mike Johnson move that bill? Do we get a vote on it? Do we get the aid? And Ukraine says, okay, we'll back down. But if we don't...
I mean, you wonder what what Zelensky is thinking. Is this a way to also pressure Putin, but pressure the United States?
Right. But the question is, what can the White House do? This is being held up in Congress. And do we think congressional Republicans are really looking to essentially provide the sort of support the White House is looking for? So it's going to be very interesting to see how the dynamics of aid for Ukraine play out. There are a lot of progressives who are not happy providing more assistance to Ukraine on the Democratic side as well. So what does a coalition in the House look like to move this bill?
Amazing geopolitics. Let's switch gears here. As far as I know, and if I'm wrong, correct me, I don't think Israel has officially claimed responsibility for this attack on the Iranian embassy, but it was F-35s. Let's just assume, and there's been numerous reports, including stuff you've written in your must-read notes, that it was. If Israel were to go into Lebanon, then what?
I mean, that is really, when we think about
it. Because it's not just an if. No. It's almost leaning toward a when.
I mean, Israeli officials have indicated that unless Hezbollah pulls back from the border and basically complies with the UN resolution that ended the war in 2006, that they're going in to move Hezbollah back from the border. There are 80,000 IDPs in Israel that are not returning home. And so they're basically saying, like, we need to provide a safe zone for people to go into the north of the country. So the Israelis have been pretty clear that if Lebanon, if Hezbollah stays in their positions, they're going in. And there's some question about whether some of the attacks that we've seen in Syria are laying the groundwork for that. Syria is the weapons highway that connects Iran to Lebanon.
But as we know, and as you've written about, Iran sanctions they've not been going well. They've been adding tens of billions of dollars to their available foreign currency reserves, which allows them to fund the war machines, the Houthi rebels, etc.
Stories of funding the war machine.
It's kind of amazing, isn't it? What if Israel were to go after Iran's oil? What if they just started blasting Iranian supertankers?
I mean, can you imagine? I mean, that would be the ultimate nightmare for the White House in terms of energy prices over the summer. I mean, I think the more interesting question is, everyone talks about the Iranian response. I think the Iranians will try to calibrate it to try to, not have a direct confrontation with
the United States. And they need the money. Iran needs to sell their oil. They have to sell the oil. But if Israel really wanted to hit, just like Ukraine hitting Putin, if Israel wanted to hit Iran, they go after the money.
I think that is the most important question, is how far is Israel willing to push Iran, to push the Hezbollah issue, to basically address their security concerns.
I don't think Israel cares if U.S. gas prices go up.
And I think that is the biggest wild card. Like, is Israel really willing to risk a confrontation with Iran?
So much going on right now. Amazing. Glad to hear that you're here, Halima, to help us make sense of it. It's complicated.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you. All right, higher oil and higher interest rates also impacting stocks today. The Dow down nearly 400 points, but still close to an all-time high. The NASDAQ did fall as well. The big winner of the day, we just talked about oil and gas. Phillips 66 up nearly 4% on the oil price spike, the big decliner. Humana down 13%, hit by a lower-than-hoped-for jump in Medicare reimbursement rates. They went up, just not as much as some investors had hoped they would. Get a quick check on futures, very mildly in the red. All right. We are just getting the engine fired up here on Last Call and On Deck. Shares of a major chip maker getting whacked right now. The who and the why coming up. Plus, it is time, D-Day, for Disney. Can a billionaire, Nelson Peltz, pull out a last-minute plot twist against Bob Iger and company? Stay with us.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
All right, let's get back to tomorrow's news tonight. Some of the stories and headlines you and Wall Street will be talking about tomorrow. And here's one that is not good news for Intel shareholders. Company suddenly rolling out major losses in its chip-making unit. Now the stock and investors are paying the price. The stock is down about 4%. Christina Partsenevelis joining us now with more on what exactly is going on here. So what's going on here?
Well, Intel is really trying to convince investors of better profitability as they separate the economics of their fabs from their chip design. So what that means is it's taking the manufacturing hubs and their Intel products and creating two separate P&Ls, profit and losses, to better highlight the metrics of Intel's businesses, starting with Q1 2024, so right now, with the hopes that it would eventually improve its valuation. Why? Because you look at the individual businesses and then you add it up and you say, oh, look, Intel should be worth more. Its latest 8K, which came out today at 4 p.m. Eastern, says Intel expects foundry operating losses. So again, that's the manufacturing hub to peak in 2024 and then hit a break-even level for operating margins at the midway between now and the end of 2030. So instead of just saying 2027, they're covering their bets and saying the midway of those 6 years. And they're also targeting non-GAAP gross margins of 40% and 30% for non-GAAP operating margins. But even if you don't understand all of those numbers, what that shows us is it's still 6 years away. And that's why you're seeing the stock react negatively, because Intel confirming that the foundry business did operate at a loss of almost $7 billion last year. When you compare that to just its product business that includes data centers, networking, that actually had a profit of $11 billion. So there's quite a discrepancy between both of those businesses, and that's why a lot of investors are a little concerned about future profitability, you know, turning that business around in the short term. The company blamed the lack of profitability for the foundry business we just talked about on the, quote, weight of past decisions and significant front-loaded investments. Think building fabs in Ohio and elsewhere across the country. It's not cheap. And then also creating these new five new nodes in 4 years, that's not cheap either. And so that's why the breakout of their business today is so important to Intel, because the foundry business can now be compared to, let's say, TSMC, Taiwan Semi, the largest foundry in the world. And then their product business can be compared to other chip makers like AMD and NVIDIA. So it's about breaking it out and having better comparisons and benchmarks.
Yeah, and another tough day for Intel stockholders. Christina, I have a feeling we will see you all day on CNBC tomorrow. Christina P., thank you very much. All right, in the meantime, tomorrow's a big day in Burbank. Disney's shareholder meeting kicking off at 10 a.m. Pacific time. It's pretty much an understatement to say that a lot is at stake, possibly including the legacy of legendary CEO Bob Iger. That is because billionaire Nelson Peltz is aiming for two seats on Disney's board. He thinks that Iger and Disney leadership are steering the company in the wrong direction. A number of Disney's most recent movies have been flops. Ever hear of Secret Invasion or Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania? If not, you're not alone. Despite this, the early read is that Iger and Disney are ahead in the shareholder votes that have already been cast. It's a good start, but tomorrow is really the big test. Now, we know that you may not care a lot about this fight between Disney and a really rich guy, but remember, this could end up changing Disney from the inside out, including the movies they make. So what is likely to happen? Joining us now is senior research analyst at Needham & Company, Laura Martin, and Puck founding partner, Matt Bellany. Matt and Laura, thank you both very much. Laura, first to you. I understand Peltz wants change. Disney stock is actually 40 bucks off its low. It's well off its high, but it's in an uptrend. It's done pretty well lately. What do you think plays out here?
You know, I think because the stock is up 35% this year compared to the S&P up 10, that he's bought his way into another year of his own board. Because I think a lot of the things he's been implementing, his activists, and he has several activists here, have suggested, and he's adopted them, and they're working for the stock. So my guess is he gets his board, his 12 board nominees, elected.
Matt, I love some of the stuff that you write in Puck, and you talk about, really, there's no way that Iger is thinking that Peltz you know, a super rich billionaire, 81-year-old billionaire is gonna do this. And he looks like he's ahead in the early voting, but Peltz has been underestimated many times before, as you know.
True, but the fact of the matter is Peltz does not have any entertainment experience. He's never served on an entertainment industry
board. Well, MSG, call that entertainment sports, but yes.
Okay, very, very tangentially related. But he's also not offering substantive ideas here. All of the things that he put in his very lengthy deck that he shared are all things that either Disney is already doing or things that they have tried and not done for very specific reasons. So, you know, you can make the argument that his other nominee, Jay Rizzullo, is the former CFO of the company and would have experience and be a new voice there. But Peltz himself hasn't really made the great case that he is the one that can help this company.
Yeah, but you point out, Matt, and I'll go back to you, Disney is unlike a lot of companies, okay? A lot of companies we talk about every day on CNBC are massively owned by institutions and pretty much nowhere else. Disney, sure, they got institutional ownership, but they're also owned by millions of retail investors because it's Disney. So that alone has made this fight not only more newsworthy, but more expensive, as you note in the article, for Disney to fight because they got to reach all these millions of people that own 8 shares.
Absolutely. I mean, between 30 and 40% of the company is owned by these retail or individual shareholders. And the cost of reaching them has been tens of millions of dollars Disney has spent on this fight. Some estimates are higher than 40 million. They're running ads. They're calling. They're doing phone banks. They're reaching out to people that you would not think would get the attention of a company as large as the Walt Disney Company. And the Trion side, the Peltz side, they're doing the same. They're also reaching out. And Peltz has been doing a media blitz, profiles in the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, all trying to reach these people. Shareholders saying they're getting multiple calls from these people trying to woo them. I mean, it's been an enormous time suck and, frankly, probably a diversion or a distraction from what Disney should be focusing on right now.
Laura, talk to us about where this all began. I mean, Disney, legendary company. We know cables had issues. ESPN, just our entire industry is completely changing / dissolving in front of our eyes. That said, movies used to be a no-brainer for Disney, right? Marvel, you just slap a Marvel name on it, and it wins. Has not been the case lately. Do you think a lot of this comes back to the forcing out of Ike Perlmutter a number of years ago?
You know, it could be, Brian. I think there's a couple secular things at issue here that give Trion a better chance of winning. One is the succession was a huge nightmare. Bringing in Bob Chapek and then spending 14 months undoing everything he did is the biggest flaw in both the board and in Iger's personal choice. Of course, film not having a positive return on capital is another opening to allow activists to get involved. And then, of course, ESPN, which used to be a 30% of revenue here, is down to like 10 because we have cord cutting. It used to be the big sort of earnings driver. And now parks are a third of revenue, but they're 3/4 of actual profitability because ESPN isn't making more money. And that's not getting better. So some of those things are structural and some of them are fixable.
Well, tomorrow's the big day. It is the vote. Disney looks to be ahead, but long way to go on a very widely owned stock. Laura, Matt, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
All right, still ahead. The tax deadline will soon be here, and a big ruling has just come down yesterday on one of the most important deductions out there. If you haven't heard about it, you will next. Plus, the shocking price jolt on an everyday item consumed by millions of you. What is now spiking in price? We'll tell you coming up.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Time have your daily RBI, and if you're like me, you love a good cup of coffee. And if you do, you've no doubt noticed that pretty much like everything else these days, you're paying more, maybe a lot more. And here's why. The price of one major type of coffee bean is soaring. It is called the Robusta. It's a major crop in countries like India, Vietnam, and elsewhere. And shortages in the crop have sent the price of these Robusta beans to the moon. Robusta bean prices are up 66% in a year and have jumped 158% in 5 years. Prices for this type of coffee have never been higher. Now, they usually average about, I don't know, $1,800 to $2,000 a ton. Today, it hit over $3,600. Now, the price of the higher-end Arabica bean has not gone up quite as much. It's up, but not nearly as much. But if you drink brands like Café Bustelo, Lavazza, Nescafé, Folgers, or more, you're probably going to see some more price hikes. Dare we say, brewing. I'm sorry. It's a dad joke, and I'm a dad. All right. Now, to taxes, because while a big cup of coffee can give you a nice jolt, if you live in a higher tax coastal state, you probably got a huge different kind of jolt from the so-called Trump tax cuts for the rich. And we're guessing that jolt was probably a higher net tax bill. That's because a lot of those tax cuts, and if you're listening on Sirius, I'm doing air quotes, also limited the federal deduction for what you paid in state and local taxes, known as SALT. That deduction was capped at $10,000. Now, if you itemize your taxes in states like California, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, or more, that probably severely limited your itemized deductions, resulting in a net higher tax bill, even with the slight cut on the top end tax rate. Now, some states tried to challenge the legality of that cap, but that challenge was thrown out yesterday. Now, the cap is set to expire at the end of next year, December 31st, 2025. But there is a chance that the cap could be extended by Congress because it would lower tax revenue by ending it at a time when the federal government is growing desperate for more of your money to pay for its out-of-control spending. Let's talk about what's likely to happen now. Joining us is SkyBridge Capital founder Anthony Scaramucci and a man who you may not know is actually like a sneaky good tax expert, and that's why we appreciate you coming on, because you worked in the Trump White House briefly, but you were there. And when they rolled out these cuts, and both my parents are accountants, and so I've done my own taxes for about 25 years, I turned to my wife and I said, we're doomed. Because even though they were being portrayed as tax cuts for upper income people, that cap just destroyed a lot of people, even middle to higher income folks in coastal states. What do you think is going to happen with that cap, Anthony?
Well, I think if the Biden administration stays in power, I think there's a good chance. And also, if you get Democrats take over the House, I think there's a good chance that they'll expire, and that'll benefit people like you and I that are in these high tax blue states. But, you know, just to go back, because I think it's an interesting story. I mean, when I was still talking to President Trump and he asked me about this issue back in December of 2017, I said, you're really going to hurt these states and it's going to crimp the economy. Because remember, these eastern cities, these coastal cities, and also the cities in California are the ones where all the immigrants show up. And there's a lot of poor immigrants that show up, as you know, Brian, and those safety nets are very important. And remember, people like Sergey Brin or Larry Page, they entered the country. They may have entered the country poor, but then they went on to grow Google, one of the most successful companies in the history of the world. And so it's very, very important for the United States to maintain these safety nets in these big coastal cities. And I think it's impaired the economy. I think it's fractured these cities. And of course, we've seen almost 500,000 people leave New York State since we got this put in place. Well, so
I don't know if you remember at the time, I think I coined it the blue state payback. And I get a lot of viewers are watching here all over the country. We love all of our viewers, no matter where they're located. But they're thinking, well, you guys are idiots for living where you live. Like a lot of us, we have to live. I've got a TV studio here and I love all my colleagues. The reality is that they don't understand that a $20,000 standard deduction, while not nothing, is not that high. If you're a middle class family in New Jersey, you could easily be paying 15 to 20 grand on property tax on, by the way, a median-sized home, in addition to another 30 to 40 in state income tax and then other local taxes. This is not just the rich. I mean, this is higher income blue state voters that are being hit here.
Well, also, if you do the differential, you know, states like New Jersey and New York put more into the federal government than they take out of the federal government. And so that's another big issue for states like New York. But the truth be told, the planning that happens in a state like New York or New Jersey was on those deductions. And so, you know, I would like to see these states tighten up a little bit, cut taxes so that we can bring people back into these states and create more of an aspirational laboratory for people. But I do believe that Joe Biden's going to win the election. I don't think he'll get the House. And so this will be a hotly contested thing come December 31st, 2025. But just remember this, if you're in one of these states, you do get some infrastructure, you do get some benefits. You may be seeing these articles about people leaving Florida and coming halfway home to places like North Carolina, where they have more infrastructure and better public school systems. So I'm not a big fan of this. I think it hurt the economy long term by hurting these coastal cities. And I think it's just bad tax planning by the federal government.
But here's the
thing. And of course, I speak like a New Yorker, so I'm probably, people will think I'm talking my book.
Well, you
but
are.
I do think this reverberates through the economy.
So am I. I live in New Jersey. I'm not going to lie. My wife's got a good job as well. I mean, we got destroyed on this thing. And here's where the weird, nobody cares. Here's where the weird thing is. This is like a weird moment in time, like the vortex of the universe has opened up, Anthony, where I think President Biden and Republicans are kind of on the same side, right? Because this is the Trump tax cut. But if it expires, it could mean lower tax revenues because things change. Local Democrats, they want it to go away, but I don't know if the federal government wants it to go away. How does President Biden play this?
Well, listen, you know, Senator Schumer is going to have a big part in this, and you know that you don't want to see these laws. You don't want to see these laws made, right? It's like making sausages. But there could be a deal cut. And remember, it's a $10,000 cap now, but a $50,000 cap would help all of those families that you're describing. It probably doesn't help the ultra wealthy as much, but it would help those families. And there might be a good compromise in there where it's above $10,000 but below $100,000. And there could be a horse trade there that helped these states. And by the way, remember, you put people in New York and they do well, you get more federal income tax income from those people. And so I think it hurt them. If they do a full-on differential and they look at these big, big cities, lower taxes in those big cities would actually lead to more tax revenue for the federal government. And so that's something that hopefully our politicians in New Jersey and New York will make that argument when it comes time to do that next year.
I think the horse trading is going to be unbelievable because it's a contentious issue pretty much everywhere. Anthony Scaramucci, love getting you on. You spiced up the conversation with a little bit of salt discussion. Anthony, thank you. Appreciate it.
Good to be here.
All right, coming up, it may have been a rough day for your money, but there's one critical number that many of you may be missing ahead of tomorrow. That's next. All right, welcome back. Not a great day for the markets. We're going to show you the futures. Very thinly traded at this hour, so take it for what you will, and they are mixed. All right, we know today was a tough one. But before you start calling your broker on your rotary phone, calling your broker, consider this eye-popping stat from our friends at Bespoke. It has now been 279 trading days since the S&P 500 had a 2% pullback. That is more than a year of trading days. And it's one of the longest streaks without a 2% pullback ever recorded. Big picture, investors like you still sitting pretty well despite the recent sell-off. But all good things may come to an end at some points. The question is, when do we get, or do we get, a meaningful pullback in the market? Because this ain't it. Let's talk about it with Catherine Rudivera, chief market strategist for StoneX. And, you know, we've been going up for so long. that the fact that when your dad was a pilot, we were at 36,000 feet, we went to 35,000 feet to level off and people are panicking. But the plane is still flying pretty good. When do you think that we might get an actual pullback?
We're not going to get it while we have economic growth where it's at. One full percentage point above potential, which in the United States is 1.8%. So when the economy is growing at 2.8%, that's pretty robust. So remember in 2023, Brian, the beginning of 2023, the market was expecting 75 basis points of rate cuts. Didn't happen, but market didn't care. Market rallied regardless, 26%. Mm. Why? Because the economic growth was so robust. So if 2024 is a repeat of 23, and we get economic growth remaining robust with a disinflationary process, the S&P 500 is going to move higher. And I'll point to one other technical factor, which is major breakouts. Major breakouts as defined by a new two-year high over the past, a brand new two-year high over in the past 1 year. The next year usually has an average of 15% return. So that's a major breakout. We've already seen record highs. So probably this is going to be a good year. My bet, and I've been saying this on your program, is hedge it. Hedge your bets, buy the put options, stay long equities. This is not the correction. Yeah. The correction comes when we see unemployment jump and recession in the offing.
This is not the correction you're looking for. A little Star Wars reference. I will say this, Catherine, which is, and I'm getting old, so I'm going to be the old man yelling at the cloud right now, which, and I've got a dirty secret to tell you and everybody listening and watching right now. 4.3% of the 10-year is not historically high. Mm-hmm. I know we think it is because we went down to zero during the pandemic and we rode along at 2 and 3% for a long time. But to your point, if the economy stays strong, we can absorb a 4.5% or even 5% 10-year, I think.
Yes, and I'll add one point, which is outside of economic recessions, back-to-back earnings recessions are a historical anomaly. So we had one last year. We had a multiple expansion. We had 25% S&P expansion last year based on multiple expansion, expecting earnings recovery in this year. We're probably going to get it. I expect 8% expansion in earnings. And if we continue to see this economic growth, I think risk assets do relatively well. But this is not a rational market in my view, so it can end irrationally. My point, Brian, is protect your positions, protect your risk positions with cheap put options, with two-year treasury notes. The $6 trillion sitting earning 5.3% in money markets, that's unlikely to go to equities. That's more likely than not going to a complementary asset class, which is, in my view, the two-year treasury.
Just to your point, and you don't want to be a fearmonger, but to your point about downside protection, it's not that expensive to buy a put. You know, just have a little insurance, if you will. And by the way, the next block, we're going to talk about why home insurance in your home state of Florida and others have gone crazy. But that said, we led the show off. I don't know if you saw the top with Halima Croft,
yes,
which is Ukraine's going after Russia. Good, but it's heating up, not cooling off. Israel may go into Lebanon. It's heating up, not cooling off. Iran's all ticked off now. It's heating up. It's not cooling off. And China continues to saber rattle around Taiwan. We could wake up one day. We're one headline away, I think, from a 1,000-point drop on the Dow.
I couldn't agree more. Geopolitical risks are huge, and the repercussions are immense on inflation, on economic growth as well. So I do think there are underpriced risks that the market has woefully underpriced, and we would be smart as investors to bake into our portfolios.
Yep, that's it. And we are lucky to live here where we're sort of immune from the physical aspect of this, but not immune from, I think, from the fallout geopolitically from it. Catherine Rivera, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
All right, programming note. New York Mets owner and aspiring hedge funder Steve Cohen is sitting down on Squawk Box. You're going to hear what he thinks of current market conditions, the Mets. Is the Mets season over yet? Has it started? Is it, Kareem, is the Mets season, are they out of the running already? Okay, anyway, big interview tomorrow with Steve Cohen tomorrow, 8:15 a.m. Eastern. Coming up, shut the front door. Financial crunch is coming for homeowners, and it's likely not the worst you've seen. We'll talk home insurance and what's really happening next. All right, let's get to your last call watch list, because while stocks may have slipped overall today, some insurance companies continue to hit new highs. Allstate and Progressive touching intraday records during the session. But the stocks, of course, not the only thing going up. The average premium for homeowners insurance now expected to exceed $2,500 nationally by the end of the year. That, according to insurance comparison company Insurify. And that represents a 6% year-over-year increase and, get this, a 20% jump in just 2 years. And for some states, the new rates could represent double-digit percentage cost increases. Joining us now with more is Insurify Director of Data Journalism, Jessica Edmondson. Jessica, critical Critical topic. Wish we had more time, so I apologize. It's short. Roughly, why are home insurance premiums going skyrocketing?
Well, insurers need to continually adjust their premiums in order to match the growing risk of damages often caused by severe weather. It's possible that the overall home insurance premium will not increase at quite the same rate as it has in the last couple of years. In addition to more frequent natural disasters, part of the recent spike is a result of skyrocketing home building materials and labor costs during COVID-19. But that has since leveled out, so we don't expect to see that have as great an impact moving forward.
Yeah, but because here's the interesting thing. Climate change, we've known about the risks of it for decades. For decades now, extreme storms, they've been getting worse, but they've been around for 20 years. It just feels like with COVID, so many things changed, Jessica. To your point, the cost of labor, the cost of materials have just soared. And now we're seeing insurers say they can't insure people in some areas. But it sounds like you're saying a little bit that it might start to taper off a bit.
Due to home building costs, yes. But climate change is a continuous issue. It's very likely that premiums will continue to increase in 2025 as natural disasters increase in frequency and in damages. Coverage offerings will continue to evolve, and homeowners will likely have to participate in rebuilding or replacement costs to a greater degree than they have previously experienced. On top of that, new markets are opening to fill the insurance gap. Tornado and wind and hail coverage are being offered as standalone policies.
It's amazing. 20% jump in a couple of years. A lot of people just can't take it. Jessica Edmondson, thanks for bringing attention to it. Insurify. Thank you, Jessica. All right, let's get out of our quicker than the ticker. All the best of the rest of the headlines.
Let's put 60 seconds on the clock. Forbes 2024 billionaires list is out, and Taylor Swift making it for the first time ever. Magic Johnson and shoe guru Christian Louboutin also joining the ranks. End of an era for a Las Vegas classic. The Tropicana closing its doors after nearly 67 years. It'll make way for a new pro baseball stadium. April off to a rough start for Tesla. An unexpectedly large drop in first quarter deliveries, sending that stock tumbling again. Music giant speaking out against AI. Stevie Wonder, Billie Eilish, and Katy Perry are among 200 artists signing an open letter to AI and tech companies. They warn the technology could endanger royalties. Jeff Bezos expanding his footprint in Florida. The Amazon founder has bought his third Florida mansion for $90 million, this one outside of Miami. And you feeling lucky? Tomorrow's Powerball jackpot now surpassing $1 billion again. Nobody won last night's drawing. This will be the fourth largest Powerball ever. Good luck. Coming up, how Caitlin Clark's superstardom could remake both the WNBA and team sports as we know it. That's next.
All right, welcome back. The ratings for last night's epic showdown between Iowa and LSU are out. 12.3 million people tuned in to watch Caitlin Clark take on Angel Reese in the Elite Eight. And that, my friends, makes it the most watched women's college basketball game ever, by far. For context, the game had more viewers than last year's NBA Finals and baseball's World Series. Not just a busy night for TV, it was a busy night for Vegas. Both MGM and DraftKings announced that the back-and-forth thriller between Iowa and LSU was also the most bet-on women's basketball game ever. Ticket prices for Caitlin Clark and Iowa's next game are going through the roof. The average ticket price for the women's Final Four is nearly $2,000. That's up about 190% from last year, according to Ticket IQ. Now, to say that Caitlin Clark is a generational talent is probably an understatement. But will this college superstardom translate into the WNBA when she turns pro? And I suspect ends up in Indiana. Just a wild hunch. Let's talk about it all with WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert. I mean, is that, Kathy, good to see you again. I mean, am I just out on a limb that she might go first to Indiana?
Yeah, you might be guessing right.
Stretch.
The odds on that won't be something you'll want to bet, but no, we're just so excited for this game and the confluence, Brian, of so many positive things on both the basketball and business side, by the way. A lot of capital coming into women's sports, you know, generational talent that you described. They have big social followings, just increased media coverage, increased asset valuation, which I know you talk about on your show. And just really, we've announced expansion of more teams in the WNBA and a global platform now that Caitlin will have coming into the professional ranks. So it's really a great time to be in basketball.
Listen, we're boring old CNBC. You're right. We like to talk about things like asset values. And I also will go on a wild goose chase here, Kathy, that Caitlin Clark coming into the WNBA, Angel Reese, she's going to make a decision, she said, soon. Just the overall growth as well with all the other competitors in the league has probably jumped considerably the value of a WNBA team. Can you give us, as a former CEO of Deloitte, by the way, can you give us an idea as to what a valuation may be now compared to 5 or 10 years ago?
Yeah, and enormously up, increasing. A lot of valuations of sports teams and leagues are based on revenue multiples. As more people watch, more people come to arenas, where more people buy merch, rep the teams, build that loyalty for teams, values go up. So I would say values have gone up at least 10 times, if not more, since I've been here, and I'm only 4 years here. And really, this is about sports is about household names, rivalries, and games of consequence. Last night's game had all three of those. And we're so excited to tip off our season in May, our draft coming up in less than 2 weeks, where Caitlin and we'll see who else declares, but Rekia Jackson and Camila Cardoso from South Carolina, Cameron Brink from Stanford. So many great players, Brian, coming into the league that are.
I'm feeling shortchanged here. As a Virginia Tech Hokie, you're leaving out a pretty quick point guard, Georgia Amora. I just got to give a shout out to my Hokies there. So Georgia, amazing, amazing run there as well. Can you give us an idea, Kathy, how do you, as a CEO of the WNBA, how do you take the momentum that college has? You've got your own momentum. College is just booming right now. I'm the proud father of a recruited D1 athlete, girl dad as well. So how do you take that momentum and convert it to the professional league, WNBA?
Right. It's first, we want to take those 12.3 million viewers and bring them into the WNBA. Yep. Make sure they know where to find us, exactly what our games of consequence are, what our tentpole events, whether it's our All-Star game, our Commissioner's Cup, or our WNBA Finals. Give them a great game day experience, like take the friction out of being a fan. And really, these generational players with these huge followings are going to allow us to do that. And expanding the league, too, being in more cities so more people can build fandom and loyalty to teams is something that's on the agenda as well.
How big would you – I know you talked about expansion. Expansion is coming. You don't want to be too big. I mean, just like any sports league, the value comes from being exclusive. You're not going to have 100 WNBA teams. We get that. Right. But how big do you think the NBA could ultimately be? And your fellow league in the NBA, Kathy, they've got a huge TV contract coming up. How do you handle the media rights side?
Right. Same thing. We have a huge negotiation coming up over the next year or so. We've had great partners with ESPN and ABC, Disney, and other partners as well that show our games. And it really is about media coverage. It's really about media rights. That's what funds so much in men's sports. That's where it's been undervalued on the women's side. We're literally changing that dynamic. And I think these generational players like Asia Wilson, Breonna Stewart are in the league today, as well as, you know, Caitlin and Angel, et cetera, are really going to change the game for us and drive that value of that media right up. And then we'll be able to pay the players more and give them more benefits that they're looking for. So that's on the horizon for sure. And there's never a better time to be negotiating that than now.
I love it. You're in a great spot. The league's in a great spot. It's not just Caitlin Clark. It's Angel Reese and Georgia Moore and so many others that are making it just good basketball. By the way, just good basketball to watch. Kathy Engelbert.
Right, that's what I said. Play on the court too, Brian. And then the next generation with Juju Watkins and Hannah Hidalgo and Kiki Rice, watch out for them too.
Watching out for it all. And apparently 12.3 million people are watching as well. Kathy, really appreciate it. Thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you, Brian.
All right. All right, let's wrap it up with this, folks. Do you know what happened 56 years ago today? No, I wasn't born. One of the greatest sci-fi movies of all time made its debut.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
I mean, who can forget that scene from 2001, A Space Odyssey, computer taking over. Now, Stanley Kubrick's film actually opened to mixed reviews back in 1968. Many critics said it was just too cerebral, too smart, too slow for the average moviegoer, kind of insulting. But the movie slowly did become a hit and is now one of the American Film Institute's top 100 films of all time. 2001, A Space Odyssey banked more than $60 million at the time. And that, my friends, is nearly $400 million in today's dollars. And that, my friends, is also the end of this show. That's it for Last Call. We'll see you tomorrow. Shark Tank is next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, package-less and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.